This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Unqualified, Love and Relationship Advice from a Celebrity Who Just Wants to Help. By Anna Faris, with Rachel Birchie, with a foreword written by Chris Pratt and read by Fred Sanders. This is the author, Anna Faris. To Chris, your wisdom and strength have made me a better person.
Foreword by Chris Pratt. When I was asked to write the foreword for Unqualified, Anna's memoir, I immediately said yes without even thinking about it. And boy, did a lot happen between then and now. So much. Like, so much. So, allow me to start by asking some questions. First and foremost, what is a foreword? Like, you know, what is it? Is a foreword an anecdote? Like that time Anna and I went to the Beverly Hills Library and I told her it was the first time I'd ever been in a library, and then she looked at me like I must be joking, and I pretended I was joking. And boy, did we laugh. But I wasn't joking. Is that a foreword? I don't really read books all that much. I mean, I know how to read, as in sounding out words and phrases, sentences, and the like. I can spell, too. I'll stop now. I feel like I'm bragging. But let's just say books aren't really my specialty, per se. I do read a lot of screenplays. May I paint you a foreword in screenplay format? Fade in. Interior, bedroom, night. Chris Pratt, early 20s, roguishly handsome, stares blankly at his phone. He blinks a couple of times. Chris. Siri, how do you write a foreword? Siri. Searching. How to go right and forward. Chris. No, stupid. Siri, what is the definition of foreword? Siri. Searching. What is the definition of forewarn? Chris. No. Siri, give me foreword definition. Siri. Searching. Give me forearm definition. Chris. Yeah, show me that. Distracted, Chris begins watching forearm workout videos for several hours. Fade out. Credits roll. Thunderous applause. Oscar nom, best short film. Hashtag blessed. Okay, back to it. Crickets. Stares at phone. Literally, Googles the word forward. Wow. Okay. So it's actually spelled F-O-R-E-W-O-R-D with an O and an E. Who knew? Siri did, of course. We've been through a lot, her and I. Anyhow, lesson learned. Now, let's move forward and discuss someone else with whom I've been through a lot. My Foreword by Chris Pratt. Anna is an important part of my life, and she always will be. She asked me to write this foreword, and I'm doing so because I love and respect her, and told her I would. She and I have a striking number of similarities. We were both raised in Washington State, just 20 minutes from each other. Coincidentally, we didn't meet until working together in L.A. I played football on her high school field, a fact I've pointed out every single time we've driven past that school in 10 years, to which, every time, she reacts with a gracious amount of faux wonder. Kind sweetheart. We're both actors who made it in Hollywood, being cast as intelligently played idiots. Me, Andy Dwyer, her, Cindy Campbell. We both have scars on our left hands, the results of drunken accidents that left us with nerve damage. We each had dead bug collections before meeting, and even though they're not the same, Linda Goodman, author of Love Signs, claims our astrological signs are the most compatible with each other. But there are a few differences as well. For one, Anna is a voracious information collector. She reads, hears, watches, and retains an inordinate amount of stories, from podcasts and NPR pieces to New Yorker articles. She'll often pore over the newspaper while simultaneously watching a TV show and blow-drying her hair. She reads the Big Five, the New York Times, LA Times, the Seattle Times, the New Yorker, and The Economist, whereas I read the Big Five sporting goods ads, looking for good deals on guns and rollerblades. Anna is kind, possibly to a fault. I'm proud to say we each approach most human interactions with politeness and patience when required. We're both well-known actors, and it's worth mentioning, fame can be a pain in the butt. But we're thick-skinned, and despite what it may seem, we'll be just fine, regardless of what you think of us. She's been in the spotlight longer than me, yet continues to be the voice of reason in uncomfortable situations regarding our lack of anonymity. When approached by fans and photographers, she smiles and shows kindness, as do I, although my annoyance and bubbling anger with paparazzi tends to be more thinly veiled. Anna is graceful with strangers and fans because she is actually wildly interested in every person she meets. She asks great questions. She communes with anybody and makes an instant connection with each person she meets, which lasts a very short time. Like a goldfish, 3 seconds, turn around and you're strangers kind of way. Almost like Dory from Finding Nemo or the movie Memento. And that person, that nameless, forgotten person, knowing full well the moment is over, still somehow walks away feeling charmed and deeper in love than before. That's just how intoxicating she is. Being TV and film stars, we live a circus lifestyle, pulled this way and that by jobs, strangers, lives on the road, all in service of the crowd. I see it as a calling in terms of the platform I've been given and a job that keeps me from breaking my back doing construction. For Anna, acting is a passion. She simply loves it, more than maybe anyone I know. There are home videos of her playing made-up characters from as early as 8 years old. She started younger than that and really hasn't stopped since. On set and off, she is constantly slipping into character, often her go-to clown, the awful party girl you may have seen in Just Friends, perhaps the greatest supporting role in a comedy by anyone ever, no hyperbole, as well as many more with our son. She lives to entertain. And finally, more than anything, Anna deserves this book. I can promise you it will be a great and interesting read. A face-first dive into the mind and person that I spent one amazing decade with and will, for the rest of my life, amicably co-parent a human. She is the amazing, effervescent, former short girl, theater nerd, camp counselor, crossing guard, headgear-wearing, feistmeister, character-playing Anna K. Faris. I was such a late bloomer I had to actually learn social skills to survive and developed wit to get by and then turned hot later. Fan of Real Housewives, Good Times, Extravagance, Prudence, herself, her family, podcasts, books, White Guilt, Neurosis, Great Foods, repeated deep musical moments, Mornings with the Newspaper, Small Bites, Feminism, and more. And in all the years we were together, I don't think I smelled her farts once. They're probably not too bad. Enjoy.
Introduction. I wrote a book. I am not qualified to write a book. I might as well have woken up one morning and thought, what can I do today that I have no experience doing, that I'm sure to make an ass out of myself while doing, and that will test a population's patience with my mental ability? Write a book. So I called my agent and got a book deal. Bingo, bango. Anyone can do this. Truthfully, though, I'm terrified. I should have done a better job of thinking this through. You know how the biggest decisions in your life never appear as the light bulb flashes you see in cartoons, but instead germinate in the deepest crevasse of your brain and slowly take root until suddenly a blossom emerges in the forefront? That's pretty much what writing a book was for me. An idea I toyed with now and then, which eventually became more now than then, and suddenly I was pursuing literary agents, and before I had a chance to come to my senses, I was documenting my life, or at least my life in relationships, in writing. As my mom keeps reminding me, I do have a degree in English from the University of Washington, a school that, after 5 long, hard years, taught me that I am unpleasant to be around after smoking weed out of a 4-foot bong. But I don't think anyone in my 17 years of living in Hollywood has ever actually asked me about my education. That's kind of the beauty or horror of LA. No one gives a shit about any credit outside of the industry. So writing a book seemed like a fun, exploratory journey into the literary world and a nice way to flex those English major muscles. But now the train has left the station, and I feel as though I'm bound to disappoint many people in my life, including you, dear listener. I'm an actor, and I have been since I was 9, so I should point out that I have been hiding behind characters and other people's words for a long time. There is always an out. Writing a book and putting my own words into the world is terrifying in the very way that performing in front of a camera will never be. In 2011, I naively and arrogantly agreed to be the subject of a profile in The New Yorker. It was written over the course of 6 months, and when the fact checker called me a few weeks before publication to read my own words back to me, words that I had spoken and completely forgotten, I knew I had to leave the country for good. My own vanity was about to destroy all that I had worked for in Hollywood. Ultimately, that didn't happen, but I did have to make a couple of apologetic phone calls. Other small points of concern, I haven't used a computer properly ever in my entire life. When you have a job where you make faces and say other people's words, you don't have to learn technology. Sometimes you don't even have to learn how to dress yourself because nice Laura is there to zip you up. So anyone at your neighborhood nursing home is more qualified to be punching these little buttons on this here keypad. In fact, I think I may have even had a typo in the title of this chapter. Rote is spelled R-O-T-E, right? I also don't know why I can't nap. I know that's not related, but it is sort of in the way that I want you to know everything about me, dear listener. You and I will be best friends after all this is over. I would like it if you would send me your autobiography too. Oh, and I'm really bad at social media. Why do I need to record everything online? Can't I just keep it in my brain? But I'm told that it's necessary to sell a book these days. So, just so we understand each other, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. That's never stopped me before, though. Actually, that's not true. Until I was 19, I thought I was supposed to know everything. I didn't, obviously, but I accepted that there was a universal understanding that we all faked it, and the polite thing to do was to quietly continue the charade. I knew to lay low and keep quiet so I wouldn't get made fun of. Then one day, during my sophomore year at University of Washington, I was sitting in the back of Intro to Something. Psychology? Sociology? I can't remember. I was miserable at the beginning of college. I sat in the back of giant lecture halls writing letters to Dustin, the just a friend I was in love with who was studying abroad in Spain, when this good-looking fraternity guy raised his hand. I don't know what the professor was even talking about, just that the dude with his hand up said, "I don't know what that means." I remember a record scratch in my head. Somebody just confessed they didn't know something? There was so much bluster. Everyone was always pretending they had all the answers. So it came as a shock to me that it was okay for someone, especially a hot frat type, to say, "Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe you're all gonna think I'm stupid, and maybe I am, but I don't understand." There's liberation in admitting you don't know what you're doing. For me, it took years of comedy acting to get there. When you're shooting a film like Scary Movie, you have to constantly confess that you have no idea if something is going to work. And it turns out it feels good to say, "I don't know how to do this." So let me say it again. I have zero qualifications, and no one should be listening to me. And yet, I want to help you with your love life. I do. I have advice to share. Who you should date, who you absolutely shouldn't, and some cautionary tales too. Plus, I'm fascinated by other people's relationships. In fact, I'm fascinated by other people's lives. What they ate for dinner, who they slept with last night, it's all equally interesting to me. And while I don't like to butt in, I do love to offer helpful, if sometimes unsolicited, wisdom. That's butting in, isn't it? I'm the worst. I'm a horrible person. I've been doling out romantic advice my whole life, most recently and most publicly on Anna Faris is Unqualified, the podcast I co-host with my friend Sim Sarna. But my penchant for digging into other people's personal lives started decades ago. When I was 11, my mom's friend came over to our house sobbing. She was ranting about how awful her husband was, and I eavesdropped until I couldn't stand it anymore. "You have to leave him," I butted in. She had two kids, but who cares? Kids, schmids. I was passionate about this. It was the only logical solution. She could run away and start a new life. She should totally leave him. Why didn't she just leave him? It would be so easy. Just leave him. When she didn't, because of course she didn't, because life is complicated, I was profoundly disappointed. My craving for a relationship of my own started before I played therapist to my mother's friend. For as long as I can remember, I wanted a boyfriend so, so badly. My mother, a ferocious feminist, couldn't stand how boy crazy I was. She hated Pretty Woman, and she didn't let me watch Grease because she disapproved of how Sandy changed herself for Danny in the end. She was adamant that I never be dependent on a man, and it created a massive inner conflict in me. I knew I wasn't supposed to long for a boyfriend as much as I did, which just made me want one more. I'd stay up late reading Sweet Valley High books, and even though I knew they were kind of stupid, I got off on the drama. The idea of boys fighting over me made me dizzy, probably because no one ever did. I bribed Jason Sprott, the fastest boy in third grade, with ice cream just to get him to talk to me. In the absence of a relationship of my own, I lived through other people's. I read Dear Abby and listened to Dr. Joyce Brothers and watched Sally Jesse Raphael. I did theater work around Seattle and was riveted when the lead actress flirted with the hot set dude. I wanted so intensely to be grown up because to me, the defining feature of adulthood was getting to be in love. When I was 17, I started dating my first official boyfriend, Chad Burke. He was unbelievably good looking, but also, shall we say, dark. Chad was popular thanks to his looks, but he was also cynical and angry and would sneak out at night to write Rage Against the Machine lyrics on telephone poles in our town. I couldn't believe that someone that hot would like me, and I was young, so I would have done anything for him. We went out for a year, and like Felicity, I followed him to college. 2 weeks after the school year began, he wouldn't return my pages. It was 1994, or come to the phone when I called his fraternity. I got drunk and went to his frat house, and they wouldn't let me see him. Eventually, we ran into each other, and Chad casually told me he was dumping me. Clearly, I didn't have as much of a handle on the whole dating thing as I thought I did. After Chad, I went from one relationship to the next. Because I was constantly trying to make a bad thing work, I was a serial monogamist, and I'm embarrassed to admit that it used to take meeting another person for me to realize that, oh, this relationship might not be working. I've had my share of romantic troubles, and what has continually provided me with comfort is the knowledge that millions of people out there have been through what I've been through. Heartbreak and rejection are communal. Love is life's greatest mystery and wildest adventure. God, that's so fucking corny. I started a relationship podcast because, to me, giving advice and hearing other people's stories is better than therapy. Not that I'm in therapy, I probably should be, but I find it too frustrating to not know anything about the person I'm talking to. The two times I've visited a therapist, I found myself asking about them. "I don't see a ring on your finger. Are you divorced? That must have been hard. Tell me everything." And they politely but firmly deflect and steer the conversation back to me. Then I try to get them to tell me about their other patients, which they seem to think is against some sort of rule. Hearing other people's problems is, in its own weird way, comforting. It's a relief to me that so many of the trials I've had, other people have had too. And while I may be unqualified, I'm not uninterested. I care and I listen, and maybe I don't always give the best advice, but I really do try. I dig a lot. I have no problem asking anyone anything. I'll try to curb my own obnoxiousness by saying, "I know this is personal," but then I go in for the kill. "How did you and your husband meet?" Or, "Oh, you're online dating. How does that work? Ever get catfished?" Some people really respond to it, other people really, really don't. I know what you're thinking. That all sounds great for a podcast where that girl who looks like Mina Suvari can take callers and have a conversation, but what's going on with this book? Well, apparently, after 2 years of hearing other people's stories, I've learned a few things about myself, about dating, about the commonality of lust and heartbreak and desire and rejection and giddiness. I've been reminded that whether you're in LA or Atlanta or Dubuque, your pride will be wounded after a breakup. You'll struggle to tell a friend when you can't stand her boyfriend, and when you're truly happy, you'll know it. I've learned that there are some universal truths. If your closest friends stop showing up to your barbecues, you're probably in a bad relationship. And if you opt for kindness over teasing, you're probably in a good one. I've come a long way since that night in 1987, when I so cavalierly told a mom of two to up and leave her husband. I don't get a rush from encouraging breakups anymore. These days, I'm more interested in bringing people together. In fact, just recently, a friend of mine was going through a bad breakup, and thank God I was there. She and her ex had had this incredibly passionate, whirlwind courtship. Within 2 months of meeting, they were planning the wedding. But then they broke up, which was not entirely surprising in a situation like that. Shortly afterward, my friend came over to my house and was so incredibly upset. The more I thought about it, the more I knew I had to intervene. There was still a lot of love there. I just knew it. So I asked my friend for her phone. "What are you going to say?" she asked. Didn't she trust me? "Just let me have your phone," I said. My text was simple. "Hey, it's Anna. I don't know what you're doing right now, but will you come over?" He did, and they had a beautiful romantic night. I was so proud of myself. I got them back together and all would be fine. And like I said, I knew there was love there. I knew it. He ended up leaving 2 days later and she was devastated and I think maybe a little annoyed at me. So yeah, it backfired. Still, points for trying. In this book, you'll find stories of my relationships, both the disastrous and the heartwarming. You'll meet childhood Anna, pronounced Anna, rhymes with Donna, even though everyone gets it wrong and I never correct them, armed with flannel shirts and menacing headgear, and adult Anna with more flannel shirts but much better teeth. You'll get some advice, a few lists, and some childhood photos. I'm the short one. Listen, have fun, and please purchase the sequel. I have no idea what the fuck I'm talking about. The Motherhood Book. The Fastest Boy in the Third Grade. Remember when you first spotted him sprinting across the playground, schooling the other boys in a heated game of tag? Or the moment you noticed him at his desk, brown spiky hair sticking up in all the right places? He was the first boy to make you crave the male gaze. He made you wonder what it would be like to have a boyfriend. He inspired you to start a diary. You've been there, dear listener, haven't you? For me, that boy was Jason Sprott. Jason Sprott was the fastest boy in the third grade. You know how in elementary school everyone is known by their first and last name? Jason Sprott was always and only Jason Sprott. He had the most adorable freckles and a great smile and spiky brown hair that I couldn't resist. We were in the same class, but we were nowhere near each other on the social hierarchy. Jason was a sweet, confident kid who totally knew his own charm at the top of the social food chain. I had more of a C-level social status. It started when I moved to Edmonds, Washington, a suburb 30 minutes outside of Seattle when I was 6. I went from a blue-collar community in Baltimore where everyone was friends and had barbecues and family get-togethers to this faux upper-class neighborhood that felt incredibly superficial. I know that's counter to the perception of Seattle, but my brother and I both felt like it was different in Edmonds. When I say I'm from Seattle, it always feels misleading. Moving to Edmonds felt a little bit like moving to anywhere USA. It did not live up to the Seattle stereotype. We arrived in Edmonds in the spring, and on my first day of first grade, my mom put me in a really dramatic sheepskin coat. When she buttoned me up that morning, all I could think was, I cannot wear this to my first day of school. I was 6, and even then, I knew this was not good. A 6-year-old in sheepskin does not have the makings of social success. Sure enough, the other kids completely mocked me. It stung, but it also planted the seed for a weird clothing rebellion that emerged in middle school. During those years, I wore the most hideous sweater, Charlie Brown, but in reverse. It had more of the dark color than the light, and it was totally disgusting, but I embraced it for its ugliness. That sweater was my early fuck you to the mean girls and the popular kids and the mundane existence I thought Edmonds offered. Then, in ninth grade, I wore a Christmas tree skirt like a cape, which, of course, got me lots of suitors. Looking back over the years, I've always gotten a lot of strength from being the underdog, or what felt at the time like the underdog. Maybe that started with Jason Sprott. He had a twin brother, David, but unfortunately for David, they weren't identical. All the girls had a crush on Jason. We were in the same class. Jason sat in front, as did his girlfriend, Michelle. I preferred to sit in the back and stare at my crush and his little hair spikes. I recently found the diary I kept in third grade with pages of scribbles about Jason Sprott. I love Jason Sprott. I hate Jason Sprott. I love Jason Sprott. He smiled at me today. We were assigned our Greek gods, and he was Eros, the god of love, and I was the unsexy Hera, but he shot me with his arrow. One day, I was in the cafeteria, and Jason was behind me in the lunch line. After buying my lunch, I spent the 35 cents I had left over on the ice milk dessert. Ice milk was imitation ice cream before frozen yogurt was a thing. I guess it was better for you, but to us third graders, it was all the same. At least, it was appealing enough to get Jason's attention. Man, I wish I could get an ice cream, I heard him say behind me. I'll buy you one, I offered eagerly. This transaction, my using my extra change to buy Jason Sprott ice cream, Jason Sprott letting me buy him ice cream, went on for a couple weeks until finally he said, I'll go out with you, but you gotta know that I'm also going out with Michelle. He was a real class act. He told me about Michelle and was honest that he wanted us both. Sounds good, I thought. I'll take what I can get. Michelle was super cool and popular and had a fountain in her house, which was a big deal. The next year, in fourth grade, I invited her over to my place, and she actually accepted and came to my home. That was a shock. My mom had just bought an inflatable boat from Costco. She blew it up, and Michelle and I put it on my bed and played whitewater rafting adventure. We were laughing and really getting into it, riding the make-believe waves and capsizing onto the bed. I'd never seen that side of her. I thought we were having so much fun. A week later, the popular girls all made fun of me because I liked to play boat. But back in third grade, when my romance with Jason was blossoming, Michelle and I didn't have much of a relationship. Shortly after I bought Jason that first ice cream, she came up to me and said, I know you're going out with Jason too, and I just want you to know I'm cool with it. She walked away before I could even respond. Jason and I didn't speak to each other during our courtship. I mostly saw him during recess when everyone played tag, and of course he never got caught since he was such a fast runner. It was the hottest thing about him. But even at recess, we were G-rated. There was a big moment on the playground when Amy Gray and Sean Bryant were going to have their first kiss, and everyone crowded around them, and they exchanged the tiniest little peck. That was a pretty huge event. I remember it more than any actual education I got in third grade. The non-kiss was a monumental moment in my social education. But with Jason and me, there was no peck. There was just the lunchroom where I continued to bribe him daily with ice milk. I knew on some level that I was buying this guy. I wasn't getting his attention on my own merit. Even at 8 years old, I was a realist. So while it was exciting that he went out with me, it felt like what I imagine it feels like when you win the lottery, but you only win like $5,000. Still, I envisioned myself as the third grade Seattle equivalent of a scrappy Boston fighter. All odds were against me. I shouldn't say that, because I'm a blonde white American person, but when it came to Anna versus Michelle, there was no comparison in the eyes of elementary schoolers. I was the short girl who wore a sheepskin coat to her first day of school. Michelle had a fountain in her house. That pretty much said it all. And yet there I was, sharing Jason with her. For the first time, when it came to social status, I was A-list adjacent. Jason dumped me a couple weeks later. He confronted me at recess and said, I don't think we should go out anymore. I'm just going out with Michelle. It was a stab to the heart. I was devastated. I had nothing to give him but my 35 cents, and he didn't even want that anymore. Maybe Michelle got in his head. She was super sassy and played her cards right. I, on the other hand, was a true sugar mama. So I did what any heartbroken 8-year-old would do. I went home, grabbed an orange from the fridge, wrote Jason's name on the peel in black marker, and threw it off the deck into the forest outside my house. When I was a kid, I wanted to live in the Yukon, so I spent a lot of time in that backyard forest relishing my loneliness. I was dying to live a more dramatic life than Edmonds offered, even then. And this weird ritual, which I deemed the orange ceremony, seemed like a start. I don't know where I came up with it. I certainly didn't read a book that said to pick up an orange and write a boy's name on it in order to get over him, but I ended up doing it with a few different love interests. I must have thought it was profoundly symbolic, that by casting this fruit into the abyss, I would somehow rid myself of the hold these emotions had on me. Even at that age, it's so surprising the intensity of feelings you can have for somebody. I felt the need to be liked and the need to be popular, but I was tortured by that neediness because I was also proud and wanted desperately to be confident and independent. I thought the ritual would help. I remember throwing the orange out there and thinking, "Now I am complete! Now I am over Jason Sprott!" It didn't work. I was not released. The next day I went to school and saw Jason and saw Michelle and was just as devastated. That episode began my long and complicated journey with the idea of closure. Basically, I don't believe in it. I believe in the concept, I get why people crave it, and I understand why I, even in third grade, sought it from the orange ceremony. It's frustrating to feel so powerless against your own feelings. But as an adult, I've learned that closure is unobtainable. I think it happens at death, maybe. But remembering the pain is a good thing, because all those experiences that you can't close the door on make you a more empathetic person, and that should be embraced. I have a pattern. It takes meeting a new guy to help me get over the old one. In the case of Jason Sprott, it was another Jason. He was the newspaper boy, super cute and a little bit brooding. I left him sodas outside my house every day so he could have a drink while he was delivering papers. I was totally into bribing these guys. What can I give him out of my fridge that will get his attention? I think there are 5 pages in my diary that read, "I am so over Jason Sprott. I am totally into Jason Barry. He is so hot and such a mystery." But one day he didn't take the soda, and I think that was his way of saying, "No more, you sad girl." Despite our tragic end, Jason Sprott will always be my first crush. We ended up going to different high schools, so I lost track of him after 8th grade. He's probably changed a lot in the past 30 years, but to me, he'll forever be Jason Sprott, lover of running, subsidized ice cream, and spiky bangs. List to live by. The professions of men you should not date. I broke my own rules. Before you listen to this, a caveat. I am attracted to all of these types of people, and in large part have dated them or married them. Number 1, magician. The idea that someone gets off on tricking you is just fucked up. I dated a guy in college who loved scaring me. He would hide behind the door and pop out just as I entered a room. Of course it freaked me out, but then I'd get mad. He'd giggle and I just wanted to punch him so badly. I didn't because I don't have strong fists. But magicians have that similar desire all the time. To be clear, I love the idea of magic and the beauty and artistry around it. But the desire to trick people and never let them in on how you pulled it off, that seems to me like a person who will never fully reveal himself to you. I don't mind magicians as people, but in the realm of dating, the tendency to trick is very confusing to me. Number 2, musician. Here's my theory on musicians. When you have an audience of more than 10,000 people worshiping you, how do you go home to your partner at night and be like, "So how was your day?" There's got to be an intoxicating head rush when you look into a sea of fans and know that you could have sex with any of them, no matter their gender preference. After that, can you ever be satisfied with anything less? Plenty of musicians don't achieve that level of success, I know, but even unsuccessful musicians are looking for that kind of attention. People who follow their creative passions are fascinating, but also complicated, and they all have a tricky combination of narcissism and insecurity. The one thing that keeps some actors in check is that the crew is not laughing at their dumb jokes. The key grip is checking his phone and rolling his eyes, and he just wants to go home at the end of the workday. When you ad-lib a joke, the boom operator, who has undoubtedly worked with much bigger stars than you, is probably thinking, "What a narcissist." And you feel that, and it's humbling. But being a musician on a large stage, how do you separate yourself from the rock stardomness of being a rock star? So don't date musicians, except maybe a classical one. second chair oboe. I would stay away from first chair, and definitely not a conductor. Number 3, doctor. My experience dating doctors has been that they've pretty much been dicks. Also, I have never dated a doctor. Plus, I saw that Alec Baldwin and Nicole Kidman movie. What was it called? Malice? The one where she's complaining to her husband, played by Bill Pullman, that I hate our new neighbor, but of course she's screwing him because he's got a total god complex. That seemed realistic enough. Number 4, athlete. Not necessarily because they cheat, which I know is what you're thinking, but because if they're getting older and there's a new recruit or if they have massive injuries, you have to spend a lot of time stroking their ego. Honey, don't you worry about Brock. I'm sure he'll tear his ACL too. After a bad game, you have to be so emotionally supportive and the exhaustion will just burn you out. Plus, during the season, what are they going to have left to give you? Number 5, chef. I know, it sounds like a good idea. They'll cook for you, I get it. It's what I called the chef trap. Don't fall for it. As someone who has dated a chef 0 times, I can tell you that the culture of the kitchen might not translate to relationships. It's hot and incredibly stressful, and, as I know from experience watching Hell's Kitchen, temper is encouraged. If people have a hot temper at work, I just don't think they can avoid bringing it home. And he probably gets home at 3:30 in the morning. Number 6, therapist. I haven't been to much therapy at all. It terrifies me. Growing up, my parents were of the belief that if a person is in therapy, that was true validation they had a mental illness. But in LA, you're the person with the mental illness if you're not in therapy. So I went once, and the therapist asked me where I see myself in 10 years. I'd like to live in Northern California in a house with a lot of land and plants and maybe an amphitheater to put on plays, I said. He responded, "Do you realize that in that explanation, you didn't mention your son once?" I wanted to throw something at him. That's why I wanted to go there, Dick, to be with my son and give him everything I wanted as a kid. Would you ever say that to a man? Question his commitment to fatherhood because he focused on himself in therapy? After that, I was therapy-less for years because it made me so furious. If you date a therapist, I imagine there's silent judgment at home. Your therapist's boyfriend dissecting the meaning, underlying everything you say or do, and who wants to date someone who is going to be analyzing them all the time? Number 7, actor. We all just need so much praise. I know I do, and male actors are the same way. Still, I can't help but be attracted to them. And I know many men have actresses on their don't date list too. Of my 4 serious relationships, 2 of the men, so not a great percentage, told me their moms said they should never date an actress. Hearing it for the first time was jarring. After the second, it was like, is this really a thing? I wasn't even successful yet. I was doing local Seattle theater, and I wasn't all that dramatic of a person. I just wanted men not to cheat on me. Basically, the only profession you can or should date is a woodworker, or a guy who makes boats, like Kevin Costner in Message in a Bottle. Someone who is brooding but carves wood all day, making something gorgeous with his hands while he ruminates on lost love and finding new love and stormy seas. Ich liebe dich. Chad Burke was my first boyfriend. He was a junior, I was a senior, and as far as I was concerned, he was the hottest guy in our high school. So I couldn't believe it the night he kissed me at a Stone Temple Pilots concert. Chad was incredibly angry. This is the guy who snuck out at night to write Rage Against the Machine lyrics on telephone poles, which turned out to be a theme in my life. I spent a long time feeling drawn to angry men. Chad worshipped Steven Seagal. He looked like a high school version of the action star with a low ponytail and everything. It was 1993, back when that was sexy. Was it, though? Or was that just me? Chad was popular because he was good-looking, but not in the way well-liked people are popular. He would never have been elected the captain of a team or voted most likely to succeed or anything like that. He was a cynical, bitter teenager, but looks can get you far in high school. He was smart, too, although can we talk for a minute about how fucked up our societal intelligence scale is? Why do we gauge smarts the way we do? I say this out of pride because I took an intelligence test in high school that scored students on a level of 1 to 5, and I got a 2. The teacher told me my score and suggested that I should become a secretary, and I was so pissed off. Not because secretaries are dumb. I'm sure most secretaries are plenty smarter than a 2 out of 5, but because being told what I should or could do, as if I was too stupid for anything else, was infuriating. Similarly, I scored a 1060 out of 1600 on the SATs, and I remember this guy in my grade asking me what I got, and after I told him, he said, "Oh my God, I thought you were so much smarter than that." "I know," I said. "I thought I was too." Thank God I had parents who believed in me, because I really took that secretary thing to heart, and if I didn't have a family who constantly encouraged me, I certainly wouldn't have the confidence to write this book that I'm totally unqualified to be writing. But anyway, by conventional standards, Chad was smart. One September evening in 1993, a group of 7 or 8 of us went to a Stone Temple Pilots concert. It was exhilarating to be out with the cool kids. I was not in the popular crowd in high school, and while I mostly tried to stay under the radar, I found myself on the receiving end of mean girls or general mocking a decent amount. Being a theater kid wasn't looked highly upon in Edmonds, so for the concert, I told my mom I was staying the night at my friend Stephanie's, and instead, I went to the concert with classmates I didn't usually hang out with. So there I was with this hot dude making advances on me, and it was a whirlwind of not just physical but mental intoxication. All I could think was, this is the best night of my life. Chad and I made out, and despite the fact that we were completely stoned and smashed in a sea of sweaty fans and standing in front of our classmates, or maybe because of that, I thought it was completely magical. A couple of days later, when Chad asked me to be his girlfriend, I was overjoyed. He snuck over to my house in the middle of the night and put a big banner on my window that read, "Ich liebe dich." That's "I love you" in German. He was a big German studies fan. Chad and I got very passionate very quickly. We would look into each other's eyes and we would say we would die without each other. One day my mom looked at me and said, "Anna, I have never seen you this happy before." I hadn't told my parents about Chad because I was too embarrassed. It was incredibly important to my mom that I wasn't boy obsessed, which was a hard standard to live up to as a teenager. And of course, I was boy crazy, but instead of just embracing that as a normal phase of my teen years, I was ashamed. I thought I shouldn't feel the way I did, so I never told her anything about boys. Not Jason Sprock's ice milk or Jason Berry's sodas or anything. But once my mom noticed that something was different, I admitted that I was dating someone and that I really liked him. I showed her Chad's picture, and I remember her saying, "Oh, he's so handsome." It was gratifying to hear her say that, but I also thought, "Mom, you could not have said anything worse, because now I am diving in headfirst. If you are going to approve of this, I am so in." I was crazy for Chad. He was just so hot and angry, which were my only 2 requirements in a man back then, and I was in such disbelief that anybody so good-looking would like me that I would have done anything for him. If he had said, "I really, really, really want to have a threesome," I probably would have been like, "Great, with who? Where? The parking lot? Awesome." He was the guy I lost my virginity to. More on that later. And my first love. It was that heady rush of young love that has no basis in logic at all. I really thought we were going to get married. He gave me a promise ring. So when he decided to graduate a year early and enroll at the University of Washington, I followed him there. 2 weeks before college, Chad asked if I would mind if he joined a frat. I told him I didn't mind at all, even though I had no plans to be a part of the Greek system. The week the college started, I didn't hear anything from him for 3 days, even after repeated pages. Yes, pages. Again, 1994. So eventually, I stalked him. Yes, stalked. I knew where all his classes were, and this was a huge school. Like, 45,000 undergrads, so I conveniently found myself outside of one of the buildings at just the right time and bumped into Chad. He saw me and said, "Oh yeah, I've been meaning to tell you, I want to see other people." It was a blow. I must have known on some level. He hadn't communicated with me in a few days, which was a pretty strong indicator that something was off, but I was still devastated. So I did what any self-respecting, reluctant ex-girlfriend would do and continued to stalk him. Maybe it was more like borderline stalking. I showed up at his fraternity and his frat brothers would say, "Chad's not here," and I'd gasp out between drunken sobs, "Why isn't he here? Where is he?" Then they'd escort me back to my dorm, and it was all very pathetic and dramatic in that way that only happens during college. 4 months later, in January, Chad got kicked out of his fraternity, so he moved into a probably illegal apartment next to a Korean restaurant, which smelled like kimchi had permeated the wallpaper. Soon after that, he called me in my dorm and told me he wanted me back. I did not pass go and ran directly into his waiting arms and his waiting bed. Within the week, I realized I'd lost all sense of myself for this douchebag of a person, but instead of being courageous on that very day, I went home and wrote in my calendar that on March 14th, I would break up with him. And for whatever reason, that was the day I chose, 2 months away. I stuck it out for those 2 months, even though everything about Chad drove me crazy by then. I would stare at his long, delicate, artistic fingers and feel a tug of annoyance. His pride at wearing Tevas, as though he were a river rafting guide, made me cringe. So did his ponytail and his cackling laugh, which was usually directed at someone less fortunate than he. One time he told me, after pointing out a Darwin fish sticker on the back of a car, that he could have invented that. The worst grievance of all was his surprise at my decent acting skills in the idiotic Steven Seagal fan videos he made with his friends. But mostly, I was horrified by those fingers. Sometimes I worry that if I get dementia like my grandma, who, by the end of her life, talked exclusively about how her brother burned down the family farm when she was 9, I'll spend my life ranting about Chad's fingers. In that case, I'd like to think that my then-husband could make a solid case to the state for assisted suicide. It turned out I needed those 2 months to realize that I hated more than what I liked about Chad and to muster the confidence to put my first real relationship behind me. I needed to digest all of it before I really broke it off. On March 14th, I woke up and thought, this is the day I have to have some pride. I marched over to Chad's place and said, "I am leaving you." And he didn't say anything. He just walked to his fridge, pounded a beer, threw it at a wall, and said, "You're going to be back here in a week." At that point, I knew that even if I did want to be back there in a week, which I kind of did, I couldn't ever return. So that was the end of Chad Burke. Almost. 10 years later, right before I married my ex-husband, I tracked Chad down, which was probably a sign I shouldn't have been getting married in the first place. I called his mom, and when she picked up, I was just like, "Hey, Mrs. Burke, you might not remember me, but this is Anna." And she immediately said, "Oh, hi, I've been following your career. It's so great." The way she spoke to me and her lack of surprise at hearing my voice, it was as if we'd chatted 2 days earlier. It was so strange. I told her I'd love to catch up with Chad and gave her my number. At the time, I was in New Orleans shooting the movie Waiting. And the next night, Chad called. It had been 24 hours since I'd reached out to his mother, enough time for me to come to my senses. My phone rang, and all I could think was, "Oh, fuck, what am I doing? Why am I reaching out to my ex when I'm about to get married?" I didn't pick up. He called 3 more times. I had started this, I realized, so the polite thing to do was at least talk to him. We ended up on the phone for 6 hours. He lived in San Francisco, and he told me the most grotesque story about going to China and marrying a woman who was in love with someone else and how her family hired him a prostitute. I laughed so hard, not because it was funny, really, but because I was so relieved at how gross it was. I remember thinking, okay, I made the right choice. This is the sign I'm doing the right thing. In the end, that wasn't entirely the case, and that marriage ended in divorce. But the Chad Burke call was another instance of me reading a lot into the idea of closure. Chad was my first love, and we all romanticize our first loves, especially as a teenager, when the emotions flood into your brain in a way that doesn't happen in your 30s. I do wonder, though, why we are always so tempted to revisit that first relationship. In the very best case scenario, we have someone begging for us back. "Oh my God, you're the one that got away," they might say. "I can't believe I fucked it up. Is there anything I can do to get you back?" But the reality is that that's not going to happen. And do you really want someone to say that anyway? To be fair, hearing that the guy who treated you like crap might want you back and realizing that you're over it, that you don't need them and certainly don't want them and are actually too good for them, would definitely feel empowering. So yeah, that would be kind of great. Unqualified advice. Squad goals? When I was cast in Scary Movie, I called my friend and former college roommate Claire to tell her that I landed my first big role. She was thrilled. And then I told her that it was a spoof comedy, and with a voice full of concern, she said, "But Anna, you're not funny." "It wasn't mean. It was true." "I know," I said. "I don't know what I'm going to do." It's a very special kind of friend who can verbalize your insecurities in a way that is a show of support rather than a teardown. When Claire reminded me that I wasn't a comedian, she was saying, "Okay, how should we tackle this?" Not, "Man, you're going to fuck this up." I've never been the kind of gal who surrounds herself with female friends. I've never had that Sex in the City posse. I haven't met my ladies regularly for brunch or had a group that I just call the girls. I always wanted that, but I never knew how to get it. So instead, I clung to the man in my life at any given time. But I do usually have two or three incredibly close girlfriends, and I'm fiercely loyal to those people. For a while in my 20s, I thought it was cool to say that I was a guy's girl. I didn't realize until later how lame I sounded, bragging as though having a lot of girlfriends was a bad thing. Back then, I thought that having the approval of my stoner guy friends was of great intellectual value, while friendships with beautiful blonde sorority girls would be shameful, so I touted my male friends as if my association with them spoke to how cool I really was. But, like I said, that was lame. I was selling my own gender down the river, and I wasn't even getting any fulfillment from the relationships with those stoner dudes. The truth of why I didn't have any girlfriends probably had nothing to do with my being a guy's girl and everything to do with the fact that I was angry and jealous and unduly proud of the guys I was hanging out with. That said, I did have some precedent for shying away from packs of ladies. Growing up, I fell victim to plenty of mean girls. In fifth grade, for example, I was invited to a girl named Mandy's house for a slumber party. Mandy was one of the most popular girls in school, and I couldn't believe I was invited because I was not in her social circle at all. My mom was really skeptical, but I begged her to let me go. She did, and I joined Mandy and her two friends, Lindsay and Amy, and they made fun of me the whole time. "Let's play boat," they said when I got there, which I knew was a reference to my ill-fated playdate with Michelle a year earlier. At one point, the girls said we should all take a shower together, and they made me close my eyes, and I could hear them laughing at my body. It was fifth grade, so I don't think they were especially developed or anything. Our bodies couldn't have looked that different from one another. I think I was simply the nerdy girl who liked to play imaginary games, and they wanted someone to pick on. I'm sure they invited me to the party for just that reason. It was so wild to me that my mom totally picked up on what was happening. She knew the party wasn't a good idea and that these were mean girls. I never told her about what happened, though, because I was too proud. I didn't want her to be right. In high school, Mary Young and her crew had a running joke where they would sneak up on me and snap my bra strap. It may sound like a small thing, but when you're a quiet teenager trying to get through high school unnoticed, that kind of unwanted attention is rough. One day, I went to my locker and the words, "fuck you, bitch," were written across it in permanent marker. It was humiliating, but it was also confusing. I didn't think I was worthy of that kind of hatred. I generally flew under the radar in school, or at least I tried to. Yes, I did some acting in local theater, and I was in a commercial. I played the chubby kid in a frozen yogurt ad, for which I was paid a $200 gift certificate to Safeway. I wasn't really chubby, but I had a weird round face as a kid, and the commercial was entirely close-up. The script said, "Chubby girl, Mom, are you eating ice cream?" And I remember one of the producers saying to my mom, "Oh, she's not chubby. We just call her that because she has a chubby face." But at school, I primarily focused on how to be as small as possible. the guiding question of my teenage years was simply, how do I survive this time in my life? I did survive, ultimately. It was rough, and cool was never something I felt, so eventually I accepted my lack of girlfriends and left high school. But years later, 20 to be exact, I returned. After graduation, I kept in touch with very few people from high school. Aside from Chad Burke, with whom I lost contact after freshman year of college, there was only Megan, who is a grade below me and is currently a writer in New York. She was and is wonderful and smart and funny, but I think the thing that initially kept us connected was that we both broke out of Edmonds. So when my 10-year high school reunion rolled around, it never even occurred to me to attend. Just before my 20th, however, some girls from my grade reached out to my older brother on Facebook. They'd really like you to come, Bob told me over the phone. I didn't want to, quite honestly. Not because I'd have to revisit the Mean Girls, but because I didn't keep up with anybody. Was I really going to fly to Edmonds to attend a reunion of people I barely knew and who, a couple of decades earlier,